days beyond recall, when on the world the mist began to fall, out of the dreams that roll in a happy throng, below to our hearts love sang an old sweet song. And in the dusk where fell the firelight gleam,
welcome to episode 94 of the Blooms and Barnacles podcast, where we talk about everything related to James Joyce's Ulysses. I'm Kelly.
And I'm Dermot.
How you doing tonight, Dermot?
Pretty good.
Well, we are beset by cats as usual. So I guess we could say this is the podcast where we talk about James Joyce's Ulysses and complain about cats.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully it's more than one, more of one than the other. Anyway, before we get into our main show, we've got a little bit of business. We are a blog as well as a podcast, and if someone would like to read our blog, they can find it at
bloomsandbarnacles.com,
which is a great place to see the artwork that Dermot does for each of my blog posts. And we have a new one up that is entitled The Opal Hush Poets. Do you remember what that blog post is about, Dermot?
Yeah, this one gets into A.E. Russell, a.k.a. the Hairy Fairy, as he was called by the contemporaries who didn't like him. And so I did a tarot-themed post with this one, where I made four tarot cards. Not willy-nilly, I do know a little bit about the tarot, so I wasn't just pulling things out of my anus. So Stephen is the Fool, A.E. Russell is the Magician, the Tower, that's an easy one, that's the Martello Tower, and we have Stephen and Buck Mulligan being shattered off the roof, and Leopold Bloom is the Hanged Man, which isn't an execution as many people think. It's more of a rite of passage kind of card where he's undergoing a transformation or an ordeal or some sort of initiation. It's quite mysterious.
And once again, if somebody would like to see your images, they can find them at
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
It's a good post, guys. I really feel good about this.
We've had a request from one of our regulars to have these printed out. I'm seriously thinking about it. But to do the full 22 cards and the major arcana would take a bit of research. I think drawing them in this style was really fast. I've done tarot decks before in a much more elaborate style. These were pretty quick to do four in one day. Much quicker than I would have thought possible. But some of the cards are difficult to map on to the book. So
if you have suggestions, maybe hit Dermot up on Facebook.
Who should be Temperance? Who should be Justice? Things like that. Like other ones, like The World would be easy. That's Dublin, right? It was in the original Marseille pack. It was Jerusalem. And in the world of Ulysses, it's Dublin. Dublin's the world. Some of them are like, I don't know who in the book would map close enough for that particular imagery. So you can't just be pulling things out of the sky. You have to have some sort of grounding with them.
Yeah.
Would Mr. DC be a card, or is he too obscure?
No, Mr. DC, he could be the devil.
Like the death card would be Glasnevin Cemetery. It's perfect. But yeah, Mr. DC, I don't know.
Who would be the hermit?
The hermit? I don't know. Because we have, I guess A.E. Russell, we kind of cheat him in maybe as the magician.
And I asked you specifically to do that one because A.E. was a real magician. And also because he's major focus of the post. So.
Yeah. And these cards too are heavily based on the Rider-Waite deck, which would have been contemporaneous with the book.
And Pamela Coleman Smith, who did the art for what's sometimes called the Rider Smith-Waite deck, she's also mentioned in the blog post. She's germane to this post.
Right. We're not just being willy-nilly here.
Yeah. So I think we've talked about tarot long enough. It's been multiple people who've asked if Dermot will complete the set. And I think, you know, as novelty tarot cards, there's some thought that goes into it. So Dermot's thinking right now.
I'm thinking, yes.
Yeah. If you have suggestions, though, please email us bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com or drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Yeah.
This podcast episode as well has its own art. It's kind of our art section here. Dermot, could you describe the artwork you've done to accompany this episode?
Yeah, and I've forgotten what the source was, but it's an incubus. So it's I drew a really horrible one of like a brain slug on the back of the character, popping his skull out and mangling his brain with tentacles.
Yeah, this picture originally accompanied a blog post, which I shared in our monthly newsletter for September, which I do think is a post that's worth revisiting. And it's one that I'm not going to adapt into a self-contained podcast episode because it's about so each episode of Ulysses has a technique, and the technique of Hades is incubism. And this was attached to a blog post that describes what incubism means, because of course it means more than one thing. Some of the imagery in this, like this sort of squid monster removing his hat, is very pertinent to that description of incubism. So please check it out. Honestly, if you Google the word incubism, it'll be the first thing that comes up. A bit of business before we start. First of all, Blooms and Barnacles runs on donations, and we are very, very grateful to all of our donors, including
George Smith, David Weber, and our recurring donors. You know who you are.
We thank you very, very much. If you would like to support us in a non-monetary fashion, please drop a review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it. And finally, if you'd like to keep up with all of our news, we do issue a monthly newsletter at the top of every month, such as the one I just mentioned. All right, anything else we should talk about before we get into the show?
No.
All right, so we are officially starting to read Hades. We've done a couple of background episodes on Hades. We are now in the thick of it. This is the sixth episode of Ulysses. And if you're following along at home, today's text comes from pages 87 and 88 in my edition of Ulysses, which is the 1990 Vintage International Edition. And we are going to start off by talking about incubism. So this, like I said, is the technique of Hades, as outlined by Joyce in the Gilbert Schema. And Dermot always says it's boring when I talk about the schemata of Ulysses. But I do think they're important to kind of figure out what's going on in his head. So what is an incubus, Dermot?
It's a supernatural being who, with a sexual component, right? Like, so the incubus,
yes,
will go after a man. Or a woman.
Incubus goes after a woman.
And the succubus after the male.
Very heteronormative, these demons.
Yes, and when you sleep, and then they kind of mess with your,
yeah,
with your sleep. And I think they try to impregnate or have sex with the person.
Yeah.
So there's a sexual component.
Yes. So usually the assumption then is there's some sort of a demonic or oppressive heir to Hades, which there is a bit of heaviness or oppressiveness in the air because it's about a funeral. But is it demonic or ghastly or spectral in some way?
Mm.
That's something to keep in mind as we read through it. I liked how with Lotus Eaters, we went through and looked for the lotuses.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of want to look for the techniques and some of the other correspondences as we go through the episode.
And let's just say too, like, people wondering, why were these idiots talking about the tarot? Correspondences is a fundamental principle of magic. Mm-hmm. Like, the idea is that colors correspond to metals, which corresponds to planets, which correspond to days. There's 7, 7, 7, 7. Mm-hmm. And different colors have magical properties that map onto other things. Now, Joyce didn't believe in magic, but he would have understood the principle of correspondences.
Joyce didn't believe in magic, but there were certain aspects of theosophy, and I think Hermeticism as well, that really worked for him.
Right.
He wasn't into like the really kind of esoteric stuff, but there were aspects of it that he liked. I've written multiple articles about it on our website. Right. We've talked about it.
Yep.
And if you read that Opal Hush Poets, I talk about it in there.
Okay.
So
just wanted to get that said before.
Important because I think it's not something that people always go to right away, but I think it cannot be overstated how interesting that was to intellectuals, mm-hmm, of Joyce's day.
Yeah.
And, you know, he knew personally people like A.E. and W.B. Yeats, and later disparaged them pretty heavily in all of his works. But I do think that he was influenced by that.
Yep.
So if you want to know why, go read that post and then let me know what you think. Bloomsandbarnacles.com. All right. So back to incubism. Another sense of incubism comes from the verb incube, which is not a very common word. But, you know, honestly, incubism is likely a Joycean coinage anyway. So to be incubed means to be enclosed within a box, like to be in a cube.
Mm-hmm.
And this definition allows the technique to take on a much broader meaning and thematic resonance.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you think about to be incubed within a box at a funeral, who or what is incubed within a box?
Mm-hmm. A corpse.
Right. And also four men who are riding a carriage together behind the hearse
mm-hmm.
to the funeral.
Right.
So you can kind of see the various, you know, Russian nesting dolls mm-hmm. of things that are incubed within one another. So let's read this first paragraph and some.
Martin Cunningham first poked his silk-hatted head into the creaking carriage and, entering deftly, seated himself. Mr. Power stepped in after him, curbing his height with care. "Come on, Simon." "After you," Mr. Bloom said. Mr. Dedalus covered himself quickly and got in, saying, "Yes, yes." "Are we all here now?" Martin Cunningham asked. "Come along, Bloom." Mr. Bloom entered and sat in the vacant place. He pulled the door to after him and slammed it twice till it shut tight. He passed an arm to the arm strap and looked seriously from the open carriage window at the lowered blinds of the avenue. One dragged aside, an old woman peeping, nose white flattened against the pane, thanking her star she was passed over. Extraordinary, the interest they take in a corpse. Glad to see us go, we give them such trouble coming. Job seems to suit them. Hugger mugger in corners, slop about in slipper slappers for fear he'd wake. Then getting it ready, laying it out, Molly and Mrs. Fleming making the bed. Pull up more to your side, our winding sheet. Never know who will touch you dead. Wash and shampoo. I believe they clip the nails and the hair. Keep a bit in an envelope. Grows all the same after. Unclean job.
All right. So thoughts from you, Dermot. Thanks for reading.
So it's, I think, pretty straightforward, right? Like it's just all the guys are at Glasnevin and they're getting into the cab to, or the hansom cab or wherever it is to go on their way.
So they're not at Glasnevin yet.
Yeah, but they're heading to. So Bloom pulls the door to and slammed it twice to shut it tight, so it's a bit flimsy. So he passed an arm through the arm strap. So I guess these things wouldn't be like a modern car, right? They're going to be rocking around mm-hmm. a bit. It sounds like you need a bit of leverage.
The arm strap in particular is highlighted by a really good Joyce website called James Joyce Online Notes.
Mm-hmm.
And the writer there would really like you to know that the arm strap wasn't something that would protect you if, say, there was an accident,
mm-hmm.
but it was something that you held on to keep you jostling another.
It's not a seatbelt. It's like in the bus when you're holding onto the rails, so the G-force doesn't knock you to one side. Let's see here. So one dragged aside, an old woman peeping. Nose white flattened. So there's an old woman looking at the window as they go by, and she's probably figured out it's probably black. I guess she'd know it's like a funeral journey or something. Thanking her star, she was passed over. Like, oh, thank God, it's not me. Oh, great, because they're behind the coffin, right? It's like ahead of them, right? So she knows it's a cortege. Extraordinary, the interest of taking a corpse. Glad to see us go. We give them such trouble coming. I think that means women, is it? Yeah, because we give them such trouble being born. Hugger mugger in corners. I have no idea.
Hugger mugger means secret.
Okay. Slop about in slipper slapper for fear he'd wake. So are they wear slippers around the corpse?
That's interesting because slipper slapper, this is all my notes further down, but slipper slapper is like an old woman. She's a, do you know the term Shan Van Vocht? Like a poor old woman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of what it means, but it does make it sound like slippers for your feet.
Okay. And then so you talk about preparing the corpse, the winding sheet, which would be the body, the shroud for the body. And then when you're dead, you never know, they'll be touching you, washing you, shampooing. And then he repeats the myth of clipping the nails and the hair. They don't keep growing. It's a myth. The skin contracts, I believe.
That's right.
You keep a bit in an envelope. Grows all the same after unclean job. So he has the ickies about it all.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to do it.
once again, I mentioned the website James Joyce Online Notes. So they have a very detailed article there that has kind of a long title. In the carriage for Patty Dignam's funeral, : Bloom was right all along, which is a detailed analysis of where each of these four men were seated within the carriage. Mm-hmm. If you want something to that level of granular detail, I really suggest it. We are not going to go through that here. This is probably the last we'll speak of it, but you can find that information. I'll put a link in the show notes. All right, so let's talk about our main players for this section of Hades. Martin Cunningham. If you want to know more about him, I'd say see the previous episode. We just did a whole episode about him. His silk-hatted head is mentioned. So, author and scholar Mark Austin, in a book called The Economy of Ulysses, which is a really fantastic book about Ulysses if you're looking to add to your collection. In his opinion, hats are an example of that incubism motif, because not only are the wearers incubed within the hats, but they're identities are also incubed within the hat. So if someone's wearing a silken hat like Martin Cunningham, what do you think that says about his identity?
He's got some money.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think in Austin's book, he describes him having a pompous nature. Mm-hmm. It's more so in Grace that he behaves that way than here. Mm-hmm. But he's definitely taking on the role of the group's ringleader. Austin also talks about economic incubism. So the character's economic circumstances kind of putting a boa constrictor-like stranglehold on these guys. Austin points out that a lot of the oppression in these men's life is economic. It's often political as well, and often connected to alcohol, as we'll see going forward. Cunningham's a really good example of this because his wife has sort of imposed these sorts of problems on him, which we talked about in the previous episode. But she is a very heavy drinker who pawns their furniture for alcohol money, and then he has had to repeatedly set up the house. In some cases, like Cunningham's, these are situations they've kind of accepted, even though they're being slowly suffocated by them. So, how about Mr. Power? His full name is Jack Power. He was sort of a man on the make in Grace. We'll talk about Mr. Power as we go through the episode. But in Hades, as we'll see, he seems to have fallen on hard times. Mr. Power works for the Royal Irish Constabulary. How would you describe the RIC, Dermot?
They were the police force before independence. So we would remember the RUC from the north of Ireland, more recent times. And they would have been replaced by the Garda Síochána after 1922. But yeah, they would have been probably just the police at the time. But during the War of Independence, they would have made them like a target for IRA and nationalists.
Also known as the Black and Tans.
No, the RIC. I think the Black and Tans were folded into the RIC.
Okay.
There was a whole furor over that a few years ago when we won't get into that. But the 2020 general election was great fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think this represents, in a way, the incubism of sort of inescapable political and economic situations. Power functions as sort of an embodiment of how some Irish might use their relative power in society to simultaneously oppress their countrymen while colluding with their colonial masters. Simon. Who's Simon?
That's Stephen's father, Simon Dedalus.
Yeah. His personal, you know, oppression is his wife's death. Mm-hmm. Like Stephen, he's grieving, and it points in this episode, he grieves fairly openly. Mm-hmm. He's also in an ever worsening financial situation. If you've read A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, you'll recall that his slow financial decline caused Stephen to have to leave the elite boys' school where he was attending when he was young. It mirrors a real-life situation of the Joyce family. And as Ulysses progresses, we see how dire the Daedalus' situation is, while Simon goes out and drinks and carries on with his friends. His daughters are in the street pawning their possessions so that they can eat.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And Stephen is absent as well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that is a discussion for another episode. Bloom. We already know about Bloom's difficulties at home that are causing him some emotional oppression. There's this line here where Martin Cunningham says, "Are we all here now? Come along, Bloom." And this is a line of some interest. So this line sort of subtly hints that Bloom is an outsider, right? Are we all here now? So he checks for everyone else and he's like, "Oh yeah, you too, Bloom, come along." He's kind of an afterthought. Even in his peer group, that Bloom is kind of an outsider. And that is a theme that's very subtle here, but will be expanded on throughout the episode. And part of this is because of Bloom's different cultural and religious background, but it's also because I think Bloom is more of an acquaintance of Dignam, more so than some of the other guys. Mm-hmm. Is this true, Dermot, that in Ireland it's customary to attend funerals even of acquaintances?
I would think so, yeah. I understand in England you sort of has to be an invite. it really throws Irish people. It's more of like an open thing. Mm-hmm. And we were talking the other day about, you were asking me, was it common to have a funeral going up the main street?
Oh, hold on to that, because I was asking you about that, because I want you to talk about it.
We'll do.
But it's like moment.
When we had like workmates who would die, and you know, the whole studio would go to the funeral. Like, it wasn't just family and immediate friends. Mm-hmm. That church was packed. Like, there were 400 people in it. You wouldn't want to not go. So yeah, it's a different relationship, I think, in Ireland with funeral rites than maybe in mainland UK.
Yeah. Let's see here. Let's talk about the woman in the window. You notice she's a bit of a curtain twitcher.
Yes.
Watching the... Now, we can maybe assume that she knows the Dignams. She's their neighbor.
Yeah.
This is in Sandy Mount, outside of the Dignams' house. You know, she might know him. She might not. Dignam has a very small funeral. Only, around a dozen people attend, rather than the... kind of what you're describing. Mm-hmm. So she's pulling the curtains aside, looking out. Bloom describes it as thanking her stars she was passed over, just kind of a reference to the Jewish feast of Passover. Job seems to suit them. Now, it's true that caring for the dead was traditionally considered women's work until funerals became professionalized in the mid-19th century. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was when embalming really came in. Embalming's been around for a very long time. But the embalming as a, you know, habitual act rather than like because you're the pharaoh or something like that really became customary with the American Civil War. Even in the UK, that was because so many people died in the US Civil War. Mm-hmm. The American Civil War in the 1860s that... and people wanted their family members brought home. Mm. And one way to do that was to embalm them. And I think one story I've heard is that some of these embalmers would follow around the armies at the time and advertise their services. And some of them would get an unclaimed corpse and embalm them like Lenin style and prop them up and say, "See, look how good Jimmy the Corpse looks here."
Yeah.
This we could do the same for you.
Yeah.
And so with that, it became a professionalized job as well as a business. And then women were largely pushed out.
Mm. And during the Crusades, they would render bodies down until there was just the bones left. And they could send the bones back to Europe. That's what the church passed is widely understood. One of the church prohibitions against, you know, human dissection was to prevent the rendering of human flesh, because the body was meant to be buried intact. So it's one of those other peculiar, you know, little things that they took a dislike to.
And I should say Abraham Lincoln as well, after he died, he was embalmed and then carted across the country on a train because everybody wanted to see Lincoln before he was entombed in Springfield.
So they actually stole his body on the way. Didn't they open that casket like many years after he died and he was still intact?
I do not know, but I think he was probably pumped pretty full of embalming fluids if they took him across the country on a train in the 1860s.
Yeah. Was it summertime? It would have been pretty sticky.
Oh, gosh. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't. I don't know. I know about embalming. I don't know. I No, I've never mentioned this on the podcast, but I at one point considered very seriously studying mortuary science. Oh,
I can vouch for that. I remember you doing that.
Very, very interesting to me. So, but that's, again, a conversation for another time. So all this is super interesting to me. If you're interested in funeral customs and the history of things like this, I really recommend a podcast called Death in the Afternoon that's hosted by Caitlin Doty and several other women about, it's all about death stuff. So this is this is woman's work. It's a lady's business for ladies. I also want to touch on here the non-attendance of women. So we see an old woman looking briefly out the window, but there is a real lack of women in this chapter and at the funeral in particular. In this episode, sorry. Particularly, notably, Mrs. Dignam. And you'll see it stated in many places that it was a custom of the era that women did not attend funerals, as it was believed that women couldn't control their emotions well enough to attend a solemn, dignified affair. Mm. But it was really only an upper and middle class custom. This did not really apply to working class and to rural funerals. If you think about a traditional Irish funeral, too, there's a custom of keening.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel comfortable defining keening?
Keening, women whose job it was just to cry, and they were professional criers. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it wasn't just like tears, it was like a very specific, like high-pitched wailing.
Yes.
Yeah. That is unique, but typical of Irish traditional Irish funerals.
Yes.
So obviously not a tradition, but a product of that late Victorian, early Edwardian era.
Mm-hmm.
But only for people with a little bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
So
they began to have notions.
Well, I would say it's maybe the influence of English Victorian culture as well.
Yeah.
You know,
that's what I mean.
They were colonized people. Ideas, so if you want to look at that incubism and oppression, cultural oppression theme, that's one way this you know, open, emotional way of mourning has been repressed in favor of a more, you know, buttoned-up affair.
Right.
There's one more section I want to touch on, which is where Bloom talks about laying it out. And this is Bloom's memory of Molly and their maid, Mrs. Fleming, laying out his son Rudy at his funeral. They had a son named Rudy,
mm-hmm.
who died very young. He would be 11 years old in 1904.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as often happens, going to the funeral of his friend who has died conjures up memories of other loved ones who have died in the past. So he's remembering in that section Rudy's funeral. And, you know, Rudy's death day is about, I think, 1 week away from Bloom's day. So it is very present in his mind because... Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever really finished grieving a child who dies so young.
No, I don't think you would.
Go ahead and read the next section.
All waited. Nothing was said. Stowing in the wreaths, probably. I'm sitting on something hard. Ah, that's soap in my hip pocket. Better shift it out of that. Wait for an opportunity. All waited. Then wheels were heard from in front, turning. Then nearer. Then horses' hoofs. A jolt. Their carriage began to move, creaking and swaying. Other hoofs and creaking wheels started behind. The blinds of the avenue passed, and number 9 with its craped knocker, door ajar, at walking pace. They waited still, their knees jogging, till they had turned and were passing along the tram tracks. Tritonville Road. Quicker. The wheels rattled rolling over the cobble causeway and the crazy glasses shook rattling in the door frames. "What way is he taking us?" Mr. Power asked through both windows. "Irish town," Martin Cunningham said. "Rings End, Brunswick Street." Mr. Dedalus nodded, looking out. "That's a fine old custom," he said. "I'm glad to see it has not died out."
All right, thoughts from Dermot.
Huh. So again, this is quite conventional, you know, when you put in the the right quotations and everything. So let's see.
Yeah, it's very straightforward.
Yeah, the only things that would kind of, let's see, hop through me a little bit. It's just like, clearly they're talking about directions. I don't know if, what's that street name, the unusual one?
I'm not sure.
Tritonville Road. Don't know if that still exists or not, or that's, a lot of streets were renamed after 1922. I wouldn't know that part of Dublin that well, but it has a weird ring to it. Like maybe that got a a do-over. See her.
I can't remember if I mentioned, but they are in Sandy Mount, which is to the south of Dublin.
Oh, I see, I see. Oh, right, right. So they're a good way away. I didn't realize they were that far out. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a long drive by horse and cart, isn't it? Yeah, you'd feel that. So, of course, Bloom has the soap in his pocket and he wants to shift, but he doesn't want to be seen jingling around in his hip pocket. It would look weird. Let's see. A craped knocker. That was an odd word. So I wasn't sure what craped meant in this respect.
I think what it would be is black crepe or like black, almost like streamers, mm-hmm. but like the sad version of streamers
right.
would be hung, like black cloths would be hung in homes to mark a death. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that there is black crepe on the front of their door.
Okay. Yeah, no, that seems straight enough. Mm.
Yeah. So we see our four boys incubed within their funeral carriage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he mentions number 9, and this isn't elucidated here, but as Ulysses goes on, we learn that this is 9 Newbridge Avenue, which is in Sandymount, south of Dublin, which was near Matthew Caine's house. And to know who Matthew Caine was, listen to episode 93. So it's not Matthew Caine's actual residence, who would have been our real-life Paddy Dignam, but number 9 would have been vacant in 1904, so Joyce felt he could put a fictional Dignam family in residence there, which is a little quirk of his. Talk about circulation. So circulation as well as stagnation, two sides of one coin. The correspondent organ of Ulysses is the heart, and of course the heart is an organ of circulation throughout the body, and when circulation ceases in your body, what happens?
You die.
Yes. So a good portion of this episode is about the circulation of traffic through the heart of Dublin. So when Simon's talking about a final custom, we'll get to this in more detail in a moment here, but it's the final custom of taking funeral processions through the city center of Dublin,
mm-hmm.
up what then was called Sackville Street, what is now called O'Connell Street. So literally circulation through the heart of Dublin, the heart of the Hibernian metropolis, as it's called in the next episode, which I think is the first line of the next episode. So it's not to put too fine a point on it, but Joyce certainly did. And we see Dublin sort of through a corpse eye view, or maybe a hearse eye view, or at least a funeral cortege eye view. Anyway, so let's talk about that fine old custom. Would you agree, Dermot, that it's customary for funerals to travel through the city or town centers of places in Ireland?
My town, yeah. Like, last time I was back here a few years ago, there was a funeral up the main street. I'm sure they still do it, because the cemetery is right up. The church is on Main Street, and you go straight up Main Street, takes you straight to the cemetery. And it would be a fairly regular thing. Back before the bypasses were built, if you were traveling from, say, Dublin to Wexford, and you were going through this town, and you were unlucky enough to hit a funeral, then that's tough, because you're going to be part of the cortege for about half an hour until you can make that fork onto the Wexford Road, mm-hmm. and you're away from it. But yeah, that was like, that's one reason why drives took so long 30 years ago in this country, because you'd be stuck behind farmer tractors or funerals a lot of the time.
And should mention too, now this not the same in Dublin in this era, in 1904, but in the US where I grew up, there are also funeral processions that go through town,
mm-hmm.
But they're all in cars. And I've noticed when we're in your hometown here that they are generally on foot.
On foot, yeah.
People walk behind the hearse.
Yes.
And that the hearse has very clear windows, whereas the ones in the US are generally tinted. You can't see the coffin. But I've noticed the ones here, like a lot of glass in the hearse, and you can see the coffin and memorial things put around it, flowers and other things.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were like down the street the other day, and I walked past the funeral home, and they had a beautiful horse-drawn carriage, which was clearly for funerals. It was all black and lovely livery on it, and everything was gorgeous. So, yeah.
But I think there's an openness and a publicness to death in Ireland that Ireland's Anglo neighbors, either in England or in America, lack.
Yeah. One of my favorite shows was 6 Feet Under. And there's an amazing opening episode where the oldest son returns back to the family business mm-hmm. because his father dies. And as they're burying his father, they, you know, you're meant to pick up dirt with your hand and throw it on the mm-hmm. coffin, but they've given everyone like a little pepper shaker so you mm-hmm. don't get the dirt in your hand. And Nate just says, what the fuck is this shit? Mm-hmm. And because he said, this is, you can't sanitize death. And he throws it this one side and he sticks his hand into the dirt and he throws it into the hole. And I thought that, you know, so that's a much healthier psychic attitude than mm-hmm. trying to put it at this distance mm-hmm. far and far away from you. Like, it's there, it's going to happen to you, and you have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And it's childish to pretend that you can't. Mm-hmm. And I know people who are deeply, you know what I'm talking about, people who are like, I'm going to try to live forever or live to be 100 or whatever. And mm-hmm. it's a miserable way to live because you're not living now. Mm-hmm. You're not dealing with the reality of mortality. So there's no escape from it. Best to deal with it, recognize it, and get on with your life. But yeah, no, it's direct here because mm-hmm. the physical form of the rituals here make it very, very hard to ignore it. Mm-hmm. I was reading some of the regional papers and it was really kind of touching, like how out in Connacht, and it's interesting how, like, you read through them and there's pages and pages in memoriams. Mm-hmm. Like they don't forget, like sometimes years and years after these people have died and there's still little memoriams, mm-hmm. which I don't see as much out here. You wouldn't see that in the Wicklow people, I mm-hmm. think. But Connacht Tribune, yeah, you'll see plenty of that.
Okay. Well, thank you. All right. Let's talk about the final custom specifically that Mr. Dedalus refers to, which is the now... I work on O'Connell Street and I don't see any funeral processions going by there. But the now, I think, defunct custom of funeral processions traveling through Dublin City Centre up O'Connell Street towards Glasnevin Cemetery. And it was a way to give more people a chance to salute or doff hats in respect to the passing hearse mm-hmm. and really shows the public nature of Irish funerals. And I think that it's seen if a lot of people show respect to your dead loved one, mm-hmm. that's a much better funeral. That's mm-hmm. a good funeral. You want lots of people there.
I wonder when that died out, like going up O'Connell Street with a hearse.
My reading that I did this week about it made me feel like even by 1904, it might have been kind of on the wane. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know when it died out. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I have not witnessed it to the scale that it was described at in the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. Specifically, there's a quote from a 1917 book entitled Dublin Explorations and Reflections that the author is listed as an anonymous Englishman. And I think probably some of the things that this anonymous Englishman wrote about Ireland may have not been strictly complimentary, mm-hmm. given just the tone of this paragraph that Dermot's going to read. Go for it.
All day, and particularly on Saturdays and Sundays, the long processions wind up Sackville Street on the way to Glasnevin. Whether it's more people die in Dublin than in other cities, or simply that they die more expensively and with more pomp, I've no idea. But I have never before in my life been in a town where hearses and coffins and mourning coaches were so much in evidence.
Thus the circulation of corpses through the heart of Dublin.
And so that's 1917. So he might be taught writing about his memories of 10 years before.
Yeah, I don't know when he lived there. I mean, you know nothing about the author. Look, and I just have this one excerpt. So.
There's plenty of corpses in 1916 anyway. But he probably was writing from sometime well before. Because by 1917, that street was a bomb zone. Like it was.
Yeah.
If you look at photographs. Maybe,
and maybe that's what disrupted it.
Yeah, I don't know. And then motorized vehicles come in.
Probably disrupted it as well. Yeah. It's a very different pace of life. Do you have any reaction to his comments?
Yeah, he sounds like a bit of a kipper.
For our American listeners, what is a kipper?
A supporter of UKIP, the Brexit, the pro-Brexit party.
I wasn't
party.
Expecting that.
He got Brexit done, didn't he?
Yeah, I think there's probably a reason it's by an anonymous Englishman. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know that he wrote this in 1917. It may have been from earlier.
He's got a tone to him.
He's got a tone that, made me think there's a reason he's anonymous. So, let's talk about Bloom, who is a defier of customs. Again, this is very subtle here, but it will become more prominent as the Hades episode proceeds. So, as we'll see, Bloom doesn't get a lot of Catholic customs. We saw how well he understands the Catholic Mass. So now he's going to take that same kind of worldview and apply it to a funeral. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he kind of tries to find new ways to do traditional things, frequently to the horror of his comrades in the carriage. But to avoid stagnation, to promote circulation, and to avoid things like GPI, a general paralysis of the insane, customs must be defied or updated. So Bloom is the, you know, whatever the medicine you take for, what do you call it? Cholesterol? Clogging of arteries.
Statins.
Statins, there you go. All right. So let's keep reading.
All watched a while through their windows, caps and hats lifted by passers. Respect. The carriage swerved from the tram track to the smoother road past Watery Lane. Mr. Bloom at gaze saw a lithe young man clad in mourning, a wide hat. "There's a friend of yours gone by, Dedalus," he said. "Who is that?" "Your son and heir." "Where is he?" Mr. Dedalus said, stretching over across. The carriage, passing the open drains and mounds of a ripped-up roadway before the tenement houses, lurched round the corner and, swerving back to the tram track, rolled on noisily with clattering wheels. Mr. Dedalus fell back, saying, "Was that Mulligan cad with him? His fetus Achates." "No," Mr. Bloom said. "He was alone."
Thoughts? And thank you for reading. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they're again, watching passers-by, like, you know, the whole little hat ritual, which I think people don't wear hats because I think it was King Edward who stopped the tradition of hats.
Okay.
Edward and Mrs. Simpson, the little Nazi sympathizer king. Okay. Yeah, he was like, stopped.
This is the previous Edward to that.
Yeah, this is before. I'm talking about the 1930s. So when did people stop this hat business? And there was the whole like performative little etiquette around hats and what do you do with them? We've all kind of forgotten what it was like to have them. Anyway, they're clearly like watching people to make sure that their gift showing proper little tip in the hat, whatever. So we see the two Daedaluses. Open drains and mounds of ripped up roadway. The tenement houses, right? So at this time, like Dublin was, a lot of stretches of Dublin were very poor. It's hard to imagine now. Like people packed in like sardines to these like awful squalor. And if you want like a fictional show about that, Strumpet City, the TV show, I think you can find it online. I think it's for sale. 1979-1980 RTE drama set in 1913 during the lockout, close enough to this period. And there's some very good portrayals in that. A little stagey, but Peter O'Toole's in it and a bunch of like Peter Houston, that was a cameo, and it's well done. Anyway, he asked, was Mulligan with him, Buck Mulligan? Now, what is Fetus Achates? Fetus is that dog?
Faithful.
Faithful. Oh, Fidela, Fetus, right. Mm-hmm. Fetus, his faithful Achates, I have no idea what that is.
Achates would be the loyal companion of Aeneas.
Okay, these classicists. And I know Mr. Bloom said he was alone. All right, yeah, again, clear enough. Yeah, yeah.
So we'll talk about Achates. I'm not sure, I've never heard it said out loud, but he supported Aeneas's preparation to travel to the underworld in the Aeneid. Stephen, you know, as we see passing here, Stephen has no Achates, truly. Stephen is on his way, well, I shouldn't say, where do you think Stephen's headed? So we see the four men pass, and they see Stephen walking, and he's all in black with his Latin Quarter hat on.
Right. Wasn't he going to the newspaper office to hand in the thing? Or
a little earlier than that. He's on his way to Sandymount Strand.
Oh, okay.
Because they're in Sandymount.
Oh, okay. So he's going down to Sandymount to walk on the...
So he's taken the tram from Dalkey, where he worked, to Sandymount.
Right.
He's gotten off there, and he's going to go walk on the Strand.
Right.
He's on his way to the opening of Proteus.
These trams are pretty good. Like, they were getting people around well enough.
So let's talk about caps and hats. Stephen's wide-brimmed Latin Quarter hat, what identity is he hoping to confer to himself with this?
Oh, he's a bohemian.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. His Latin Quarter hat, he brought it from Paris. He wants to seem continental.
Right.
An identity that it seems like his friends don't really respect. But it's something that he really, really wants to show with his headwear, his headgear choice.
Yeah.
The open drains and mounds of ripped-up roadway... one commentator, I can't remember whom right now, but said this is the underworld encroaching upon the surface world of the living. Okay. I believe it's road construction. it's more interesting to think of the underworld encroaching upon the world of the living. So we'll leave it at that.
Down with his Aunt Sally, I suppose, Mr. Dedalus said. The Golding faction, the drunken little Costrar and Chrissy, Peppa's little lump of dung, the wise child that knows her own father. Mr. Bloom smiled joylessly on Rings and Road. Wallace Brothers, the bottle works, Dodder Bridge. Richie Golding and the legal bag. Golding. Collison Ward, he calls the firm. His jokes are getting a bit damp. Great card he was. Waltzing in Starmer Street with Ignatius Gallagher on a Sunday morning, the landlady's two hats pinned on his head. Out on the rampage all night, beginning to tell him on now, that backache of his, I fear. Wife ironing his back. Thinks he'll cure it with pills. All breadcrumbs they are. About 600% profit.
Thoughts?
Hmm.
I do want to notice, I believe that is Stamer Street. You said Starmer Street, which I think was a Freudian slip on your part.
My least favorite British politician, yeah.
Boris Johnson being your favorite.
No, well, it's just because there's so much competition for it these days.
For worst politician.
I'm, British people, I'm so sorry. I really am. All right.
Let's focus on the
Ulysses. Okay. So this is harder to parse because I think we're getting into like the tumble of names. The Golding faction, the drunken little cost drawer. What the heck is a cost drawer? And Chrissy Papa's little lump of dung. Good God. The wise child that knows her own father. Oh my God. So who's, again...
Do you remember, this is actually a callback to Proteus.
Yes.
Very similar language used here.
Mm-hmm.
So Richie Goulding is Stephen's uncle.
Right. So were these the people that Stephen was going to visit or was thinking of visiting but didn't?
Yes.
And are these thoughts, these are Dedalus's words, right?
These are Simon Dedalus's thoughts. Yes.
He's a bit nasty, isn't he? He's a bit mean.
He's, much like Stephen, is very good with words.
Yeah.
But has a cruel streak that I think Stephen lacks.
Yeah, definitely. So, and we have a nice, like the Wallace Brothers Bottle Works Dodder Bridge. So they're crossing the River Dodder.
The first of the four rivers to the underworld.
Right.
The Dodder.
Right. Richie Golding and the legal bag. Golding, Collis and Ward, he calls the firm. So he's a lawyer or a solicitor?
He'd like you to think so.
Okay. And now, when... This is Simon still talking
here? Now, this paragraph that begins with Richie Goulding in the legal bag is Bloom's internal monologue.
Ah, okay, gotcha. Great card he was, waltzing in Starmer Street. Maybe I did say Starmer, I know.
Yes. Said it more English than you normally would.
Okay.
Starmer.
Okay. I don't know what he means about the landlady's two hats pinned on his head, but here we have hats again.
And... Ignatius Gallagher are gallivanting down the street with the landlady's two hats pinned on his head.
Oh, like they stole her hats.
So again, yes, the identity wrapped up in the hat is they put on ladies' hats to be silly.
Mm.
Two hats at once.
Okay. So a lot of hats. And then clearly he's got medical pains, right? So his backache's killing him. Wife ironing his back.
Which was a period remedy for a stiff back.
Oh, they would do that?
You're supposed to make it as hot as you could... tolerate.
Oh God, no.
And then iron your back.
Jesus, no. Things to cure it with pills or breadcrumbs. So these pills have nothing in them, right?
Yeah, they're placebo.
Placebos. 600% profit.
Bloom, always business minded. I would say if your back is sore, you put a heating pad on it or a hot water bottle. But a hot iron is a lot.
Don't do that.
Mm. You notice that there are a lot of hats in this.
Mm-hmm.
So do you remember your squid guy being with the hat being lifted off his head? That's why you drew the hat in there.
Yes.
It's a monster that he's lifting up the guy's hat and plucking out his brain, and the guy looks very lobotomized in your drawing.
Mm.
So, yeah. I think you were trying to be funny.
Or witty. Clever.
So, Simon suspects Stephen went to visit his aunt and uncle in Sandymount, and that's why Stephen is in Sandymount, which we see partially and early on in Proteus, Stephen does consider. But we know, does he go?
No.
Aunt Sarah?
That's right, he bails.
Yeah, he decides against it.
Yeah.
So, here Stephen, like I said, is headed from the tram from Dalkey to Leahy's Terrace and down onto the Strand, which he remarks on very early into Proteus. So you can see how this is a third episode for Bloom. Proteus was the third episode overall and the third for Stephen, and that they overlap around 11 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Richie Gould. Oh, go ahead.
So 11 being another number that Joyce loved a lot.
11, yeah, and 11 is a number that's associated with death.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that the funereal chapter took place at 11.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you think about Stephen's ramblings in Proteus, he thinks a lot about death. He thinks a lot about his mother's death and the nature of death overall. And it is a very death-oriented episode, and the motif of the tide going in and out is metempsychosis, reincarnation,
right.
Another idea that he took from occultism. So go back and listen to our Proteus episodes. We spent a long time. All right. One topic that overlaps in both is Richie Goulding, who is based on James Joyce's maternal uncle, William Murray. And we did a whole episode about Stephen's relationship with them and Joyce's relationship with them in real life, which was episode 33 entitled Nuncle Richie. So back in Proteus, Stephen had imagined his father's commentary on a visit to the aunt and uncle, and I've put it here for you to reread.
Did you see anything of your artist brother Stephen lately? No? Sure, he's not down in Strasbourg Terrace with his Aunt Sally. Couldn't he fly a bit higher than that, eh? The drunken little costar and his brother the cornet player, highly respectable gondoliers, and skew-eyed Walter stirring his father no less.
Sir, yes, sir, no, sir.
Jesus wept, and no wonder, by Christ.
So that's Stephen imagining what Simon would say, and then we have up here what Simon actually said, and how much overlap is there?
Yeah, they're not too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Richie Goulding is an accountant, a cost drawer, as Simon puts it, for the legal firm Collis & Ward. And this is covered in Proteus as well. But Richie is a bit pretentious, and he would really like you to think that he might be a partner in that firm. So that's where Bloom says Goulding, Collis & Ward, he calls it, right? So he's an accountant for these legal eagles, but he is not a legal eagle himself. So there's this bit here about waltzing in Stamer Street with Ignatius Gallagher on a Sunday morning, etc., etc. Goulding was apparently quite the party animal, but now he is paying the piper, so to speak, for his wild days. Ignatius Gallagher, you might recall from Dubliners in a story called A Little Cloud, and you know he's quite the big man on campus himself. He's this famous journalist. He's been to London, and in A Little Cloud, he's come back from London, and he's kind of showing off with all his, you know, high-class celebrity friends. And do you remember Ignatius Gallagher from a recent Blooms and Barnacles post?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't.
There's a great post on our website called The Invincible Ignatius Gallagher.
Mm-hmm.
So go check that out. Does that stir anything in your memory?
Yeah, I remember that. I remember the title.
Okay. Well, you'll have to go read it then, too. So we talked about the wife ironing is back. It is revealed much later in Sirens. It's revealed that Goulding suffers from what is called Bright's disease, which is nowadays is called nephritis. And it's one of various sort of kidney diseases. And the symptoms can be quite severe. And they can include back pain, vomiting, or febrile, which means feverish, seizures. And these symptoms are exacerbated by alcohol.
Ooh.
So you can see the incubistic effect of alcohol in Richie's life.
Then the devilish part of this is when you're in that much pain, you're going to want to take alcohol
to
dull the pain, thereby making it worse.
Mm-hmm. Which, it didn't occur to me until I was writing this up the other day, but Stephen imagines him propped up in bed, working on his accounts on like a little board in bed. And I wonder if that's why, because he's actually quite ill.
Yep.
Like, it's a really serious condition. So.
Yeah.
And our final passage for the day.
He's in with a lowdown crowd, Mr. Dedalus snarled. That mulligan is a contaminated, bloody, double-dyed ruffian by all accounts. His name stinks all over Dublin. But with the help of God and his blessed mother, I'll make it my business to write a letter one of these days to his mother or his aunt or whatever she is that will open her eyes as wide as a gate. I'll tickle his catastrophe, believe you me," he cried above the clatter of the wheels. "I won't have her bastard of a nephew ruin my son, a counter-jumper son, selling tapes in my cousin, Peter Paul McSweeney's. Not likely."
Thoughts?
Fucking hell. A contaminated bloody double dyed ruffian. So, yeah, Mulligan, so he doesn't like Mulligan either, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't know exactly why his name stinks yet, do we? Or it's just like, I'll tickle his catastrophe. I love that.
You're going to love it more when I explain the reference to you.
Okay.
I'm holding back a lot right now. I'm letting you work through this.
Cause... A counter jumper's son. Is a counter jumper like a thief or somebody who jumps over a counter to rob? I don't know.
It's listed in one annotation as a contemptuous term for a shopman.
Okay.
He's saying he's low class.
Okay.
Which the Gogartys were not. Like, the Gogartys were much better off than the
Joneses. Name is St. John Gogarty, you're not low class. But that's why he's calling him that. Like he's like dragging them down, right? Selling tapes in my cousin. What? Peter Paul McSweeney. Not like selling tapes in my cousin. I have no idea what that is.
Okay.
I have no idea what that means.
Hey, like cassette tapes. He has a new Depeche Mode.
No. They're bootlegging Aha, Take on Me, weren't they? All right.
All right. I'm restraining myself quite a bit because I have lots to say about much of this. So.
All right, go ahead.
All right. So Simon, as you've astutely noted, has nothing good to say about Mulligan. He's a double-dyed ruffian, amongst other things. He's deeply stained. Right, the dye is a stain of his character. So, and Simon specifically says that he's going to make it his business to write a letter to his mother, his aunt, or whatever she is. It's his aunt. And I remember long, long ago in the very early days of Blooms and Barnacles, I did a blog post that I think ended up with the title... Who was the real Buck Mulligan?
Mm-hmm.
That was about Oliver St. John Gogarty. So go back and read that. We did a, I'm pretty sure, a podcast with the same title. But one of the things that I came across was that when Joyce stopped hanging out with his sort of, you know, elite school friends like John F. Byrne, who was a model for Cranley, and started running with Mulligan, they basically got into a lot of trouble. They drank a lot. They were scallywags and, you know, in this puckish sort of way. And that the Joyces blamed Gogarty for James's bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And that the Gogartys blamed James for Oliver's bad behavior. Mm-hmm. So this dynamic is very much reflected here because... Simon Dedalus has nothing good to say about Buck Mulligan, who is obnoxious, but I don't know that he's quite as evil as Dedalus is making him out to be.
Sounds like a folly of two. Like, it's just they're a bad influence on one another. Yeah.
But if you remember in Telemachus, Mulligan points out specifically that his aunt thinks that Stephen's the bad influence. And I have that quote here if you want to read it.
He turned abruptly, his gray searching eyes from the sea to Stephen's face. "The aunt thinks you killed your mother," he said. "That's why she won't let me have anything to do with you."
Right. So we see that dynamic does exist within Ulysses as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're mutually corrosive people. Like, I don't know if one's worse than the other.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to hear Simon Dedalus talk about it after we've seen the opposite.
Yeah.
I'll tickle his catastrophe, believe you me. So catastrophe, you know, we know what it means now, like a calamity, a terrible thing.
Right.
But used to mean buttocks. And lest you think I make that up, I would like you to read this remark from Falstaff to Mistress Quickly in Henry IV, Part 2.
"Away, you scullion, you rampallion, you fustularian, I'll tickle your catastrophe."
So, okay. See where that comes from. Right. And in fairness to Falstaff, Mistress Quickly had referred to him as thou hempseed in the line just preceding this.
Okay.
So he does use some strong language there, but she was being equally antagonistic. Mm-hmm. If I called you a hemp seed, what would your reaction be?
This doesn't sound good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one last little bit here. I won't have her bastard of a nephew ruin my son. A counter jumper's son. So as we mentioned, it's a contemptuous term for like a shopkeep. Mm-hmm. Selling tapes in my cousin Peter Paul McSweeney's. Not likely. So he's saying that like Mulligan is low class compared to the Joyces. And you know, obviously this is like a shadow projection mm-hmm. because Joyces are not in a good place.
No.
You know, in the Wandering Rocks, we see their daughter Dilly running around trying, like, she bumps into her father on the street, begs him for money, but he goes to the pub and spends it all on drink, and they're selling Stephen's old school books it's dark. It's very dark, actually. But in this, so you know, the Daedalus doth protest too much here, basically, to quote Shakespeare once more. Tapes refer to strips of cloth that were used for tying things. Mm-hmm. So again, it's like he's not selling anything of great value or import. He's selling, you know, low quality goods in my cousin Peter Paul McSweeney's. Peter Paul McSweeney's was in real life James Joyce's grandmother's cousin. In 1875, we'll say, he was elected Lord Mayor of Dublin. So this is a, you know, impressive relative of theirs. Mm-hmm. And he opened a store in Sackville Street that was later bought by a little shop called Cleary's. Oh. And now, Ulick O'Connor, who wrote quite a bit about the Joyces, has said that Gogarty's father never worked for McSweeney. I don't know that he was actually a counter jumper, as Simon Daedalus puts it, but he's very quick to want to smear the Mulligans, and to position himself higher and say, Stephen, who, let's be real, Stephen is living in the tower at, you know, and hasn't bathed in weeks and is, you know, like he's one step away from homelessness. Mm-hmm. He's pretty, not in a great place, but he's way better than this Mulligan cad, as he puts it. Mm-hmm. So, and that's where we're going to stop for today. So you're going to incorporate catastrophe into your vocabulary?
Yeah, I'd like to do that. But nobody would know what it means.
That's why it would be fun.
Well, kicky and your catastrophe sounds good, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It has the word ass inside of it. Your cat ass-trophy.
Maybe that's why.
Could be. All right. Well, I don't have anything else to say, so I'd say this is the catastrophe end of the podcast. So let's leave it there.
All right.
See you in 2 weeks.
See you then. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Blooms and Barnacles podcast. Your support means the world to us. You can subscribe to Blooms and Barnacles on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Spotify, or any other place you listen to podcasts. You can also stream our episodes at our website, bloomsandbarnacles.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles.com. If you've enjoyed our podcast, you can do one of three things to help support us. Number one, please donate at bloomsandbarnacles.com. The PayPal donate button is at the upper right-hand corner of the page. This helps us pay for coffee and for hosting fees. Two, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice. This helps more people find our show. And three, share us with a friend who you think would enjoy Blooms and Barnacles. Blooms and Barnacles is also a blog. We post new articles and original artwork semi-regularly at bloomsandbarnacles.com. Never miss an update by following us on social media. Search for our group, Blooms and Barnacles Podcast, on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at BarnacleCast. You can also send us an email at bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. We met some of our favorite podcast friends through random emails and social media DMs. We'd love to hear from you too, so don't be afraid to shoot us a message anytime. We'll be back in your feed in 2 weeks. Bye for now.